Hello, good morning. I'll add my welcome to those that have gone before. If you're new here, welcome. I haven't seen lots of people, so welcome. You may be old here, but I haven't seen you before, so welcome. Gird your loins. There's lots of scripture to be read this morning. I was asked to preach on three chapters, not actually the three chapters that are up there, chapters 42, 43, and 44, but I thought I'd go back to chapter 37. So do please reach behind you for a Bible. If there's none behind you, reach ahead of you before the person in front of you reaches behind them. And turn up to page, I think we start on page 40. And because he pulled lots of wings off butterflies when he was young, Mike Gough is going to come and read out all this scripture. So Mike's going to read all these three passages. Please keep it open. Please keep open as he reads and when he's done.
Genesis 37, verse 23, page 40. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robes, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning will I go down to the grave to my son." So his father wept for him. And then we flip to chapter 42 on page 45, 1 to 23. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" He continued, "I have learned that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you've come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more." Joseph said to them, "It is just as I told you. You are spies, and this is how you'll be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If you're not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me, so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. They said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come on us." Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood." They did not realize that Joseph could understand them, since he was using an interpreter. And then to chapter 44, verse 18, which is on page 48. Then Judah went up to him, that's Joseph, and said, "Pardon your servant, my lord. Let me speak a word to my lord. Do not be angry with your servant, though you are equal to Pharaoh himself." My lord asked his servants, "Do you have a father or a brother?" And we answered, "We have an aged father, and there is a young son born to him in his old age. His brother is dead, and he is the only one of his mother's sons left, and his father loves him." Then you said to your servants, "Bring him down to me so I can see him for myself." And we said to my lord, "The Lord cannot leave his father. If he leaves him, his father will die." But you told your servant, "Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again." When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what my lord had said. Then our father said, "Go back and buy a little more food." But we said, "We cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother is with us will we go. We cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us." Your servant, my father, said to us, "You know that my wife bore me 2 sons. One of them went away from me, and I said, 'He has surely been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and harm comes to him, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in misery.' So now, if the boy is not with us when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, 'If I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please let your servant remain here as my lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come on my father.'"
Thanks very much, Mike, and well done for listening to such a lot of text. Hands up, please, show of hands, who went to a pantomime this Christmas? Surprisingly few. What a miserable bunch you are. Well, we made our annual pilgrimage to the Hackney Empire to see Cinderella. That's Cinderella, that's Prince Charming. The story is familiar, and the routine is well known. Cinderella's father marries an evil stepmother who makes Cinderella a slave in her home, having to cope with jibes from her ugly sisters. A ball is thrown by the prince, but Cinderella is not allowed to go. She gets a break from her fairy godmother and attends the ball and dances with Prince Charming, but she has to leave at midnight, leaving behind a glass slipper. The prince tours the land to find the girl whose dainty foot fits the slipper and eventually finds Cinderella, and they all live happily ever after. Pantomimes are not meant to be serious tellings of the difficulties of life. They're meant to be frothy, full of custard pies, full of women dressed as men and men dressed as women, and various things being behind you. And of course, everyone lives happily ever after. But stop the story of Cinderella at any stage before the ending, and what have you got? A child bereaved by the loss of her mother, domestic cruelty and slavery, young love thwarted by the conditions placed on Cinderella by the fairy godmother, and the chance that the prince might find someone who the slipper fits before he got to Cinderella. These are the bits in the middle before you get to the happy ending. What we see in this morning's passage are those types of bits in the middle in the story of Joseph. We heard at the beginning of this sermon series how he was his father's favorite, and he seemed fond of rubbing it in to his brothers. He went around talking of dreams he had of his family bowing down to him. The result was the first passage from Genesis 37 that Mike read. Have a look at that with me. His brothers attack him and sell him into slavery. Look at verses 26 and 27. They pretend to be loyal to their family. So this is what it says. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood." When they tell Jacob that his favorite son has been killed and he mourns his son, verse 35 says, they went to comfort him. But look, selling your brother into slavery rather than killing him is not your only option. There is an option not to sell him into slavery or kill him. And trying to comfort your father doesn't really sound sincere when you're the reason that he's mourning in the first place. However much the other brothers may have been wound up by Joseph, they've clearly done lots of bad things. They've sold a brother into slavery, they've lied to their father, and they've caused him huge pain by leading him to believe that his favorite son is dead. The only person that shows any sign of remorse is Reuben, and it looks like Judah is the ringleader, doesn't it? Now look at the second passage that Mike read from Genesis 42. Time has passed. Joseph, as you'll know if you've been listening to the sermon series that we've had over recent weeks, Joseph has gone from being in charge of the household of the captain of the Egyptian guard to being falsely accused of rape, to being in prison, to interpreting dreams, to being forgotten, to being summoned by Pharaoh, to being appointed pretty much prime minister of the whole country. And now the brothers come again, because Egypt is the only place that has food at the time of famine. Look at verse 6. They bow to the ground. I hadn't realized when I did this that this was something that was going to move, but that's Anne Hathaway accepting an Oscar for having dreamed a dream at that dreadful film, Les Miserables. So there we are. It came true. Now, Joseph's dream comes true at this stage. His dream of his family bowing down to him. Look at them, they're bowing down to him. And you might expect at this stage for him to do one of two things. He either decides to forgive his brothers and move them over to Egypt, where all the food is, or to punish them for having sold him into slavery all those years ago. But he does neither. He pretends he doesn't know them, and he makes a random accusation of them being spies. Why does he do that? I don't know. We're not told. The Bible doesn't say. Maybe he wants to test his brothers to see how they behave under pressure. And it works, doesn't it? They think he's an Egyptian who can't understand their language, but he can overhear them talking. Verse 21, have a look at that. Verse 21 of chapter 42. The brothers acknowledge that they did wrong in selling Joseph into slavery, and they think these bad things are happening to them as a result. It's not just Reuben this time who realizes they did wrong. The other brothers seem to have come round as well. Now, time passes again to the third passage that Mike read out. There's a bit of a hokey-cokey with the brothers leaving Egypt, coming back, leaving, coming back. Joseph messes with their heads by giving them grain and leaving the money that they paid for that grain back in their sacks. They get concerned that they're being set up, and they're right. Joseph has given orders for a cup from his table to be hidden in the sack of Benjamin, who's Jacob's new favorite son. And when the cup is found, he confronts the brothers. And now Judah speaks up. Judah, who took the lead in selling Joseph into slavery all those years ago. He talks about how his father loves Benjamin, but this time there's no resentment, as it was when Joseph was the favorite son. There's no desire to lie to his father again if Benjamin is taken away. He pleads for Benjamin to be allowed to return and offers himself in his place. Judah, who sold his father's favorite son into slavery, offers himself as a slave to save his father's favorite son. He puts himself in harm's way, whereas previously he had put others in harm's way. What a change. What a change. Here's a man, Judah, who's had a total change of heart. He was selfish and scheming. Now he's selfless and caring. What's brought this about? Well, again, we're not told. But let's think of some of the things that have happened since Joseph was sold into slavery. Lots of time has passed for the brothers to reflect on what they'd done. There'd been a famine which brought the brothers to Egypt for food. And why was Joseph there? Well, Joseph was there because he was in the right place to interpret the dreams of the Egyptian cupbearer, and the Egyptian cupbearer was in the right place when Pharaoh had a dream that needed to be interpreted. Joseph was in prison because he was falsely accused of rape by a woman whose slave he was. And Joseph was that woman's slave because he was sold into slavery by his brothers. So there's a change of heart, and there's a prophecy fulfilled over a long period of time by the happening of lots of things, not very many of them good. Famine is bad. Being falsely accused is bad. Being in prison is bad. Being forgotten about is bad. Having favorite children is bad. But all these things came together to bring about what happened. So let's ask ourselves, when do we stop the story? We're not yet at the happy ever after, but it's not far off. Do we look at Joseph being sold into slavery and think that's the end of his life? Do we look at him being thrown into prison and think that nothing good can come of that? Do we look at the brothers' actions in selling him into slavery and think there's no hope for them in their guilt? Or when do we stop our story? Maybe you're in a good place. Maybe you're happy for life to carry on pretty much as it is now. And maybe you're not. Everyone has hidden pain in their life, and some more than others. Maybe you're at the stage where that pain feels acute. Some time ago, I read a novel by a writer called Tracy Chevalier called Girl with a Pearl Earring, about the life of the assistant of the painter Vermeer in 17th century Holland. And there was a passage in it that struck me then, which I'm going to read out now. This is what the painter's assistant says when she looks at a painting that Vermeer is doing in its various stages of completion. This is what she said. "I had never seen a painting made from the beginning. I thought you painted what you saw using the colours you saw. He taught me. He began the painting of the baker's daughter with a layer of pale grey on the white canvas. Then he made reddish-brown marks all over it to indicate where the girl and the table and the picture and the window and the map would go. After that, I thought he would begin to paint what he saw, a girl's face, a blue skirt, a yellow and black bodice, a brown map, a silver pitcher and basin, a white wall. Instead, he painted patches of colour, black where her skirt would be, ochre for the bodice and the map on the wall, red for the pitcher and the basin it sat in, another grey for the wall. These were the wrong colours. None was the colour of the thing itself. He spent a long time on these false colours, as I called them. When at last he began to add colours on top of the false colours, I saw what he meant. He painted a light blue over the girl's skirt, and it became a blue through which bits of black could be seen, darker in the shadow of the table, lighter closer to the window. To the wall areas, he added yellow ochre, through which some of the grey showed. It became a bright, but not a white, wall. When the light shone on the wall, I discovered it was not white, but many colours. The pitcher and the basin were the most complicated. They became yellow and brown and green and blue. They reflected the pattern of the rug, the girl's bodice, the blue cloth draped over the chair, everything but their true silver colour. And yet they looked like they should, like a pitcher and the basin. After that, I could not stop looking at things. So the author describes how the painter paints with the wrong colours, but the wrong colours turn into a better painting than might have happened if the painter had started with what his assistant thought were the right colours. What is God painting with us? What picture is left at the end? Well, the book of Romans in the New Testament tells us the answer. This is what Romans 8 says. We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. What comes at the end of that list? What's God's ultimate aim for our life? What's the good that he works for those that love him? Those he justified, he also glorified. Is God painting in the wrong colours in your life at the moment? Do you think that nothing good can come of the situation you're in? Maybe Joseph felt that way when he was sold into slavery, or when he was thrown into prison, or when he was forgotten for 2 years by the cupbearer after he interpreted his dream. Think of that. 2 years of waiting for the key to turn in the door, thinking finally he's been remembered. I wonder how long it took him to lose hope. And yet here he is, second in command in Egypt, with his brothers bowing before him as he dreamed they would. God doesn't move with the speed or in the direction we would wish. It's taken 20 years for a change of heart from Judah and 20 years for Joseph to have his brothers bow down. It's taken lots of bad things for those things to happen as well. How would Judah's heart have been turned if he hadn't have been in Egypt because of the famine? How would Joseph have come to Pharaoh's attention if he hadn't have been in prison and met the cupbearer and interpreted his dream? How would he have been in prison without being falsely accused? How would he have been falsely accused without being sold into slavery? God used all these bad things to fulfill the prophecy that Joseph had. God promises for those people who follow Jesus to bring them to glory, and he works all things together for that good, even bad things. So where should we stop our story? Where should we stop Joseph's story? When he's suffering injustice, or when he's in power? You see, here's the thing. The Bible makes it clear that those who follow Jesus face more than their fair share of difficulty. There's a list in Hebrews 11, and this is what it says. It says, there were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went around in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and in holes in the ground. Why? Why? Had these people displeased God that all these bad things happen? Well, this is what the Bible says. They were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You see, the people that passage speaks of endured those terrible things rather than walk away from the faith because of their hope, their believed-in future to be with God. They believed God's promise. They knew their story hadn't stopped. Judah, in our passage, offers himself in place of Benjamin to be punished. Ultimately, we have confidence in God's promises because one of Judah's descendants offered himself in our place to be punished. When do we stop the story of Jesus? Do we stop it on the cross? Well, it didn't stop there. Do we stop it when he rose again? It didn't stop there. It won't stop until he returns in power and gathers his people to himself to live with him forever. That's when all our stories stop. Not with the triumphs or sadnesses of today, wherever you are on that spectrum, but with the ultimate sadness or the ultimate triumph when we're brought to glory or cast out. God has promised that for those who follow him, there'll be a coming to glory. When God is painting in the wrong colours in our life, that's what the Bible promises. That's what we cling to.